Yet again to respond to another Espoir Malpapai budget. But before...
Honourable Member, the standing orders require or allow us to, or members to give an explanation of what they have said in English, in Creole. So, and also for the purpose of the recording, if you would first say in English what you've said, and then you may explain it in Creole if you wish.
Thank you for your guidance, Madam Speaker. But Malpapai is a male pauper tree, Madam Speaker, and it does not bear any fruit. Therefore, it is more than proper to describe this budget in this particular context. But before I enter into the cauldron of this debate, Madam Speaker, I would like to refute a few arguments advanced by members opposite yesterday. Madam Speaker, I remember quite clearly that the member for Miku North, as well as the member for Denry North, arguing that the Labour Party did nothing for agriculture, especially the banana industry. Madam Speaker, I wish to quote, "What has Labour done for bananas?" And I shall make it a document of the House. It states, and I quote, "What this shows is that between 1992 and 1997, when the UWP and John Compton were in power, St. Lucia's banana production dropped by almost half, from over 135,000 tons to just over 71,000 tons. Since 1997, St. Lucia's production has dropped by 58%. And this is what the United Workers' Party will not admit. What the UWP will not tell you and do not want you to know is the fact that the St. Lucia Labour Party government has done more for bananas than any government in our history. The SLP government wrote off $44.7 million of debt owed by the St. Lucia Banana Growers Association to make sure that the new company, SLBC, did not have any obstacles in its path. The Labour government made available $3.65 million from the European Commission to pay severance for the SLBGA staff. Three, the SLP government used $16.3 million of EU funds for the banana production recovery plan, which was supposed to stop the decline that had taken place in the banana production while John Compton and the UWP were in power.
Honourable Minister for Agriculture, you have a point of order.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't want to disturb the Honourable Member for Labri, but I would like him to indicate to the Honourable House the document that he's quoting from.
You have a name of, does the document have a name? I think the member wants to know what exactly is the title. The name. Does it have a title?
Yes, okay. I did indicate the name, so I'm going to say it again. It what Labour has done for bananas. That is the title of the document.
Thank you.
If I may continue, Madam Speaker, to quote from this document, "For to help the farmers improve the quality of the bananas, our government constructed three modern inland reception and distribution centers at a cost of $12.5 million. Between October 2000 and March 2001, the SLP government provided $2.5 million to help control leaf spot on banana farms. Six, at the end of 2000, our government gave another $1.4 million to the banana industry so that the price of banana boxes or cartons could be reduced by $1. Seven, in April 2001, the Labour government provided $3.5 million to the Banana Industry Trust to set up a revolving input credit scheme so that banana farmers could get credit for inputs. In 2005, we put another $3 million in this program. Eight, between April and December 2001, we spent $2.5 million in funds from the budget to help control leaf spot. Nine, so far, we had made available another $20 million from SFA funds to put irrigation and drainage in Roseau, Cul-de-Sac, Mabuya Valley, Canals, and Maki. 10. When our government realized that the banana companies were no longer providing extension and technical support for farmers, we set up the Banana Emergency Recovery Unit to help farmers. With the help of the Caribbean Development Bank, the European Union, and using local revenue, we have given the banana industry through the Bureau over $23.5 million, plus another $4.5 million after Tropical Storm Lily to help with rehabilitating fields and to prepare for Europe GAP. Madam Speaker, if I may continue, we conclude 11 and 12. For a number of years now, our government has made all banana inputs 100% duty-free. That means that government collects no duties and no taxes on the agricultural inputs that are used in the banana industry. And 12, and this year, that was then in 2006, our government put another $1.4 million in the banana industry to help farmers put irrigation lines on their farms. Unquote, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, I challenge members opposite to emerge with a similar document to demonstrate what they have done for farmers in this country, Madam Speaker. And then we shall expose the reality of things to the masses, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, during the glory days of the banana industry, what members opposite did for the farmers, that they today, they could look at the Labour government, the Labour Party whilst in government and say, we did nothing for the farmers of this country. Gentlemen, through you, Madam Speaker, and lady, you see, from 1987, the European Union signaled with clarity that one day preferential treatment would come to an end. From 1987. And when you can anticipate external shocks, Madam Speaker, you must prepare for it. You must save during the good days so that you can cushion the impact during the hard and rocky times. Did the United Workers Party administration prepare the farmers for that particular reality? And the answer, Madam Speaker, is a categorical no. And therefore, I hope that members opposite would exercise an abundance of caution before they come to this honorable house or in street corners and accuse the Labour government of doing nothing for the farmers of this country. Madam Speaker, another argument that I would like to refute was one emerging from the member for Denry North. He criticized the Kenyan-Anthony administration about the handling of the economy. Madam Speaker, I wish to put things in proper perspective in this honorable house. And since time and relevancy will not permit me to dissect the anatomy of Kenyanomics, I shall put it in capsule form. Between 1997 and 2006, St. Lucia's economy, including experienced erosion of trade preferences, decline in official foreign assistance. We grapple with natural disasters, September 11, drought in 2002, and a 360% increase in crude oil prices. Because of prudent management of the economy, the SLP government ensured that there was an aggregate increase of only 41% in the price of gasoline in this country. Madam Speaker, when the Star of Freedom rose in this country in 1997, what did we find? We found productivity growth decline, serious decline. All sectors of the economy was in problems. We were confronted with the dislocation of the entire fabric of the St. Lucian economy. When the good doctor came in, we brought back the fundamental drivers of growth to center stage. Among them, improving macroeconomic stability, improving the investment climate and enhancing the quality and effectiveness of human resources. Key economic objectives, Madam Speaker, were job creation, poverty alleviation, reduction of inequality, and overall growth of wealth. We immediately got down to business. We intensified and diversified investment in tourism, and of course the National Skills Development Center. And we were able to stimulate employment in this country. And at the end of our term, unemployment had dropped from 22% to less than 15%, to about 13.6%. The central program of the social sector address income poverty, income grants, and through works in the public works program, Madam Speaker, human capital, education, health, water, sanitation, electricity. This is why many communities that were deprived of basic amenities were blessed with it during the period 1997 and 2006. And we address asset poverty, primarily through land and housing, where we transferred millions of dollars to poor families by giving them access to productive assets. Consequently, Madam Speaker, what happened in this country? Wealth in this country was more evenly distributed than 15 years ago. The rate of indigence had dropped significantly. But I remember last year, honorable members opposite, all under the Labour Party, poverty had increased. Of course, if the Labour Party is striking at the very heart of poverty, indigence, as it would decrease, whereas those who occupy the lowest ladder, the lowest step on the ladder of social benefits, as they start to move up from the poorest among the poor, they will gravitate to poverty and then above the poverty line. And indigence decrease more significantly than poverty increase. Madam Speaker, like I alluded to earlier, unemployment dropped despite contraction in the banana fields. The industry, Madam Speaker, during the years before 1997, when the UWP government was in office, the common entrance exam, I remember poor children from the rural areas, when they failed the common entrance exam, they used to have a big stamp on their back, failure. And so they went under the banana fields without skills. And when things got rough, they became dislocated, superfluous laborers. They cannot make the transition to any other sector in the society. But we were able to reduce unemployment from 22% to 13.6%. Can you imagine, Madam Speaker, if we were in the glory days of the banana industry? Kenyanomics at work. Madam Speaker, what does a reduction in poverty and unemployment mean for the St. Lucian economy? It means that as more people are employed, they now have financial resources to demand goods and services in the economy. And of course, we must experience some economic growth. But I heard the member for Mikunov criticizing the STEP program, criticizing STEP in the wrong direction. Anybody who understands development economics will appreciate what STEP is all about. Madam Speaker, poor people have that propensity to consume. And when you place financial resources in their hand, they would demand goods, Madam Speaker. The velocity of money. And the member for Denrinoff told me that he understands economics. But you see, Madam Speaker, that was the thinking behind Kenyanomics. We were organizing the country. We were repairing the social fabric and the economic fabric of this country. Infrastructure, a critical issue for St. Lucia's development. Madam Speaker, among the things that investors look for is an adequate physical infrastructure. Now, when we came in 1997, members here knew full well that if we had to improve the investment climate, we had to borrow. And borrowing, you would be taxing the fiscal position of the country. But you require skill to borrow and manage. And whilst you can reduce unemployment and reduce poverty and put financial resources in the hands of poor people, what was happening in the country? Economic growth, Madam Speaker. If you leave out September 11th and the drought of 2002, we experienced growth throughout the years where Kenyanomics was in motion. So, Madam Speaker, despite being battered by adverse shocks, we borrowed. The IMF praised the St. Lucian government for the management of its debt. St. Lucia was rated by the World Bank as having the best climate for investment in the English-speaking Caribbean. Investors had confidence in the Labour government. We benefited from billions of dollars worth of investment. And Madam Speaker, obviously we found ourselves in a complex and fluid world situation. With the end of the Cold War, we started to experience the diversion of aid grants away from our region into Eastern European countries that had decided to flirt with capitalism. So therefore, Madam Speaker, the traditional sources were drying up, and St. Lucia had to reach out to non-traditional sources. And consistent with the UN, the One China principle, we established diplomatic relations with mainland China. And that relationship was based on mutual trust and respect, not on mendicancy. You never saw any Chinese ambassador in this country counting money in street corners like he playing brags or he's by batai kok, Madam Speaker. There was class during that period. What we invited China to do is to assist us in the domestic economy. We got the free zone. I see the Prime Minister is very happy to include it in the budget with Dubai. We have a stadium in Beaufort, Madam Speaker, and of course, the new psychiatric hospital. Now, a number of persons on the other side have criticized, oh, these are white elephants. If you must market St. Lucia as a sports tourism destination, you must have the facilities. You must have the facilities. You cannot market St. Lucia as a sports tourism destination without the facilities. You must first build the infrastructure, and then you market. So now, it is incumbent upon members opposite, Madam Speaker, to make the best use of those facilities. The new psychiatric hospital. First of all, a gentleman, Madam Speaker, came from Taiwan, and first thing he saw in this country was the psychiatric hospital being too big. Madam Speaker, let us speak about health tourism. You see, the sea, sun, and sun product is reaching a mature stage. As more countries in the world embrace tourism as an engine for economic growth, we have to compete in the global marketplace. And we have to reach out into new areas of tourism. Le Sport already put us on the map for health tourism. There is an opportunity. We are in close proximity to North America where we can use excess capacity to generate revenue to finance universal health care for our people. Make proactive use of it. So, Madam Speaker, even our nurses who are migrating may find an opportunity to stay here. They could be retained because as you link health tourism with your local health sector, you can now start to promote according to my predecessor, salubrious nexus between government and the private sector. In that, if you intend to reduce expenditure, and I'm giving you a lesson there through you, Madam Speaker, in economics, that if you have to reduce expenditure in a sustainable way, among the opportunities available is for you to allow the private sector to engage more and more in providing health facilities and proper health care, and through universal health care, you assist the people of this country to get access to good medical treatment at home at home and abroad, Madam Speaker. So, Madam Speaker, in essence, the United Workers Party government stopped St. Lucia from exploring a very good opportunity. I heard the Minister for Health talking about putting both Paulson from Golden Hope and the ordinary folk from the society, including the maternity ward, together. I met a madman, Madam Speaker, and I don't know if it's permitted in this Honorable House, but the madman told me, who's a minister there, Ikafu? Somebody kissed him and Ukadisa. And he said to me, Madam Speaker, if the minister does that, he will put a robe on him like a doctor, put his gloves, and he's going straight to the maternity ward to help give birth to children, Madam Speaker. But Madam Speaker.
Minister for Health, you have a point of order.
Madam Speaker, I think the representative for Labrie is misleading the public. And Madam Speaker, I would like him to show me a document where I said that I would mix the regular sick people with mad people. Madam Speaker, I never said that, and I would like an apology from this.
Honourable Member for Labrie, do you have a reference? Do you have a document?
I heard it on the radio, Madam. So I don't have any document. But if you may allow me to proceed, Madam Speaker.
Just 1 minute. Minister of Health, the member has said he heard it on the radio.
Madam Speaker, this is not acceptable. Madam Speaker, if you hear something on the radio at this level in this house, in this
order,
Madam Speaker, he should have proof before repeating it. And if that's the example that he's setting for people around, I think it's a bad example. So he must have proof before he says certain things like that, because this is very serious, Madam Speaker.
Okay, so Honourable Minister for Health, you are saying that the words that the member has attributed to you were not said by you. That's what you're saying.
Yes, Madam Speaker.
Were there... Do you want to give an account of what you said? I mean, what is it that the member has said that you did not say? Precisely what? Order.
Madam Speaker, if you look at the original plan for the general hospital that were intended to be built and the psychiatric hospital, Madam Speaker, they are both in the same location. And after they will be completed, it would be a walkway. That was from the plans drawn by his government. There would have been a walkway which would connect the psychiatric hospital to the general hospital. And Madam Speaker, what was said was that there would be, because of the number of buildings that are present there, some buildings would be used to house the psychiatric hospital and the general hospital would occupy the rest of the building. And
so
there would be a separation, Madam Speaker, and there would be a different entrance to both complexes.
So your point, essentially, I gather, is that you did not say that they would be mixed. Your objection is to the word mixed.
Yes, Madam Speaker.
Honourable Member for Labrie, that is the objection to the word mixed.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I just didn't include the wall separating them.
Okay, so in essence, you have agreed that it is not the word mix that you use. It's not, in fact, what the member said.
Well, I know people can jump walls, Madam Speaker.
No. That is not what I'm asking. The member is asking for a retraction of the word mix. He's saying he did not use the word mix. And are you prepared to gave that retraction of the word mixed. That is what he's objecting to.
Can I have some time to check the records if, to ensure that he didn't say mixed, Madam Speaker?
Well, in that case, you will not repeat it.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. So, Madam Speaker, if I may continue, to indicate that despite a 360% increase in crude oil prices on the world market, that never stopped the Labour government from providing support for tens of thousands of people through PRF, BNTF, and Bell Fund, providing thousands of poor St. Lucians with school bursaries and scholarships, repairing homes for the elderly, providing thousands of St. Lucians with water, providing thousands of St. Lucians with electricity, providing free medication for persons with pressure, hypertension, and diabetes. A 360% increase in crude oil prices did not lead us to burden the poor with a 113% increase in kerosene. Instead, we ensured more disposable income among certain sectors. Over 100% in public assistance to the poor. We exempted over 5,000 low-income earners from income tax by increasing the taxable threshold to 16,000. And we provided our teachers and public servants with a 10% increase so that I would cushion the effects of the external shocks. Madam Speaker, despite all what Labour had done, and we never claim that we'll finish dealing with the period, the years, the many years of underdevelopment under the United Workers Party. Because you see, Madam Speaker, in nature's irreversible onward march, new problems emerge from time to time that require solutions. Anytime you have not solved them, they have been brought forward and compounded by succeeding problems. And so we had to deal with a compounded problem as a result of 30 years of flambeau autocracy and oppression in this country. Madam Speaker, the United Workers' Party all over the country flambeau, can he must go, flambeau. Pinez toujours dit, coquille chaud pas mal pour une fouette. That's a little animal, a little insect. Said, where that's hot, it will get cold. Leo chaud, cabine, douce. That's what it means, Madam Speaker. But Madam Speaker, what did they promise the electorate? To eliminate financial mismanagement and waste of public funds, thereby reducing government's annual recurrent expenditure by $300 million. The direct opposite. They had a bloated cabinet that most people in this country say that's a wardrobe. Wanton use of government vehicles, Madam Speaker. Ill-advised decisions. Before announcement of higher gas prices, increased departure tax by $33. Or 95% in one shot. Bam! Further in pursuing macro on economic stupidity, paying $500,000 in advance to one of its hacks in the name of 6 months' rent. $1.22 million to tourism consultants. $3 million for boxing Batai Moon, with none of the additional tourists promised by the Minister for Tourism. Madam Speaker, the loss of $104 million of capital budget support from the Chinese, from the PRC. The government came here last year. In the estimates, have PRC, and in that very same exercise, they kick off mainland China. Taiwan said it's no problem. Wherever the Chinese left off, they will come in. To date, they have not injected not even 50% of that amount in the economy. But you see, when mainland China was in this country under Labour administration, They function as a partner to the government in developing this country, but not Taiwan. They have sent a campaign manager for the United Workers' Party, counting money all the time on every street corner, as if it's Batikok or it's brass he's playing. But Madam Speaker, the longest rope has an end. Madam Speaker, millions of dollars being given to American Airlines to fly a route, an existing route. Madam Speaker, this is of no economic benefit to St. Lucia. Because you give American Airlines millions of dollars, they will put it in the coffers in North America for product planning on other routes. It would make more sense you go to New York and find St. Lucians, because persons who come on vacation, they are price-sensitive passengers, and subsidize the ticket for them. When they come to Greece, they come to Badini, they come to Miku, and all the areas they spend in the local economy. That would make more sense. There would be a net benefit to the St. Lucian economy. But by giving American Airlines money to go and put in a bank account is of no economic value to this country. Madam Speaker, they promised 7,000 jobs. Instead, they destroyed STEP, forcing approximately 1,700 families out of employment. Another 400 jobs of the caretakers were destroyed. Poor people who depended solely on the caretaker program for a little income, they were taken away from them and give it to their friends that have other means of livelihood. Does it surprise this Honorable House that unemployment moved from 13.6% in the first quarter of 2007, in the second quarter it was 13.7%, in the third quarter 13.9%, and the fourth quarter 14.6%. Now, as unemployment goes up, less persons would be equipped with financial resources to demand goods and services in the country. And obviously, it does not make economic sense to victimize and to destroy people's jobs. They are reversing the gains of the past. And I remember, before the elections, we told the people of this country that if they bring back a United Workers' Party government, St. Lucia will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. A new dark age. But they succeeded in misleading the people into believing that they would do a better job. Obviously, people want a better life for themselves. They listened to the gentleman opposite and leave. And today, they cannot deliver. You see, it's one thing to mislead people and another thing to deliver. You must have the competence. You must have the cerebral competence. You must have the know-how. And you must be unencumbered by key players or backseat drivers for you to be able to do your work. Because, Madam Speaker, if the PM, if they buy gas and you have backseat drivers that chip your brakes, this country will never go forward. So, Madam Speaker, permit me to focus my attention to the budget. I remember when I stood here last year, Madam Speaker, I said, and I quote, Madam Speaker, as I listened to the Prime Minister deliver his budget address on Thursday last week, I couldn't help but take my mental flight to the mid-90s when my predecessor, Honorable Vellon Leo John, in one of his budget presentations, in response to a budget by this very Prime Minister, said, and I quote, Mr. Speaker, if a Martian, assuming that there are Martians, Mr. Speaker, a Martian had mysteriously entered this August Assembly, he, the Martian, who'd have come to the seemingly ineluctable conclusion that this Prime Minister was a virginal Prime Minister, entering his very first term in office, pregnant with the seeds of reorganization and bald intentions, unquote. Madam Speaker, I went on to say, and I quote, Madam Speaker, my predecessor made this observation for the simple reason that year in, year out, this Prime Minister would make budget presentations in this House and very little materialized. It was a lot of bluff and fluff. Madam Speaker, I went further to conclude, and I quote, Madam Speaker, I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging of the future but by the past, and judging by the past, I wish to know what sudden magic that the current Prime Minister has invented to justify those hopes with which honorable members opposite have been pleased to solace themselves and this honorable house regarding this budget. That was in one quote. That was in 2007. When I made this observation, a number of persons tried desperately to say I had no respect for the former Prime Minister and that I was saying that the Prime Minister did nothing. But I was commenting about the poor implementation record of the United Workers' Party. And this is why we are here today. Almost the same style, the same sort of grandiose ideas, as if, Madam Speaker, it is the same thing. And in Creole, we say, un goudi ek la coin. So, what I said last year, Madam Speaker, is true today. And if we return to this honorable house next year, around budget time, it will be the same story, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, during the course of this debate, we have heard much of visions, and I know there are those who have always viewed the budgets of the UWP with rose-colored glasses and dreamed dreams of a better St. Lucia under the United Workers' Party. But Madam Speaker, no matter how the Prime Minister dresses his rhetoric to give a picture of a golden future under the UWP, it is unreal and short-lived as the steam or canvas cloud. They pass with the moment of effect and are shabby and tawdry in daylight. Madam Speaker, for those who listen to the budget address and indulge in the illusions of hope, permit me to expose the budget to the sunlight of pragmatism. Madam Speaker, I would like to turn my attention to what seemed to be occupying the forefront of the attention of this nation, food prices. And we go to page 29, and the Prime Minister indicated, and I quote, Madam Speaker, government believes that ultimately the sustainable response to the crisis of rising prices is to generate productivity increases in our production processes. If we are more productive, we can increase output and workers can therefore benefit from salary and wage increases to combat the higher prices. Hence, government will examine the establishment of a National Productivity Council. This will be done in close partnership with the private sector, unquote. And he went further to indicate what probably got my honorable friend from Beaufort North annoyed, that the people must be vigilant. Madam Speaker, whilst I have no problems with what the Prime Minister has indicated, because one can interpret that in many different ways, that it's neither here nor there, but I believe the Prime Minister should have come to this honorable house, and it has been done before. Former Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, Prime Minister Pandey, he spent an entire hour during a budget presentation to list the items that government would subsidize to assist with the escalating food prices. And this government can do it, Madam Speaker. The $3 million in boxing, they could have used it to subsidize that. The $1.22 million for the super guru could have gone into that. And I heard them today talking about commission. It was corruption, now it's maladministration. The money you give to a group of people, why don't you use it to subsidize food for poor people in this country? So you see, Madam Speaker, I'm calling upon the Prime Minister to be a little bit more creative in dealing with that particular problem. Madam Speaker, I would like to go to page 14 of the Prime Minister's budget address. Development of Castries Cruise Port. And I'm quoting, During this financial year, Madam Speaker, government in collaboration with Royal Caribbean Cruises Limited will commence the development and expansion of the waterfront area of Castries to make the city a major cruise spot and duty-free shopping center that will cater to the needs of cruise tourists, hotel visitors, and the local public alike. Unquote. Madam Speaker, it raises a few questions. That if it becomes a dedicated port for cruise ships during the slow periods, how do we intend to utilize it? Are we going to make optimal use of that facility? Just a few questions, Madam Speaker. It just raises a few concerns. The development and expansion of Beaufort Port. And I quote, Madam Speaker, in the coming weeks, Dubai Ports World, one of the world's largest port operators, is expected to conclude a public-private partnership with the government through the ANC Ports Authority to manage, develop, and expand the port operations at Beaufort. And he went on to say, as part of this strategy, containers destined for the north of the island will be badged to a new inland freight depot to be established at Cul-de-Sac, and cargo will then be distributed from there. Unquote. Madam Speaker, at this time when people are concerned about costs, about rising prices, who is going to bear the cost of that movement from Beaufort to Cul-de-Sac? And it's only reasonable to infer that it will be passed on to the consuming public. And this is the last thing that we'd want to do at this point in time. So I hope, Madam Speaker, I'm just raising it, just the concerns that the Prime Minister take note. Madam Speaker, upgrade and expansion of the Hewanora International Airport. And I quote, the preparation of a master plan for the complete redevelopment of the Hewanora International Airport to increase its capacity to handle passenger traffic, increase cargo and fixed base or jet operations, and to increase the quality and number of retail outlets. Unquote. Madam Speaker, again, I am going to give the Prime Minister, through you, expert advice. Madam Speaker, during peak periods, sometimes Hewanora becomes congested. And we saw in 1991-92, the departure lounge was expanded to accommodate peak periods. But during the week, it's a white elephant. But that extra capacity, it has to be lighted, has to be cooled, it has to be cleaned. And I can say to you, Madam Speaker, moving from the terminal that was there prior to that expansion and now, the utility bills are extremely high. Now, Madam Speaker, what can we do about that situation? I wish, Madam Speaker, to quote from a document titled An Examination of the Viability of Operating Two Airports in St. Lucia, the University of the West Indies, July 2001. And I quote, it is most unfeasible for the current state of operating two airports in St. Lucia to persist unintervened. To date, financial statements reveal that the current dual airport operation is not economically feasible. A direct implication of this situation is the financial pressure exerted on the SLASPA to spread thinly the financial resources of the authority. Additionally, estimates indicate that the country is currently losing 15% of international traffic due to the existing operation of two airports. Unquote. It went further to state on page 25, and I quote, empirical evidence suggests that economic viability will be better achievable if the current situation transforms into a single airport operation. Any recourse to operate one airport in St. Lucia would have to be in favor of Hewanora International Airport. Unquote. That's just for the Prime Minister's information. Madam Speaker, I wish to make another document available to this Honorable House, and I would like to quote from the economic impact of rationalizing St. Lucia's airport infrastructure from Cranfield University in the United Kingdom, September 2003. It states, and I quote, "The methodology entailed a comparison of the economic performance of St. Lucia's two airport system with a scenario where Huonora International Airport was operated as the island's sole airport. It addressed two specific issues, namely the economic benefits of transforming into a single airport operation and the socio-economic implications associated with that transformation. It went further to indicate, Madam Speaker, and I quote, the study found that the proposed single airport operation will generate a greater amount of both aeronautical and non-aeronautical revenues. It also found that if Huonora International Airport is operated as the island's only airport, it would provide a much improved framework for attracting a greater number of international passengers and carriers to St. Lucia. Further, it revealed that consolidating the island's international and regional traffic into a single airport will allow St. Lucia to function effectively as an international gateway within the OECS subregion, as well as a pre-clearance point for passengers to and from other OECS states using St. Lucia as a hub. When the socio-economic implications of closing George F.L. Charles was considered in the context of St. Lucia's wider socio-economic realities, the study concluded that there will be a net benefit to the business community and the island as a whole," unquote. Madam Speaker, I would like to conclude my deliberations on that aspect of ports by quoting on page 15 on the expansion of George F.L. Charles Airport, and I quote, "Madam Speaker, it is the intention of this administration to construct a new airport terminal at Point St. Victor on the opposite side of the existing terminal at the George F.L. Charles Airport. The airport runway will be extended to cater for medium-sized jet aircraft such as the Boeing 737-800 that is operated by most major airlines. And the existing terminal will be refurbished for use as an FBO for private jets," unquote. Madam Speaker, again, I would like to give the Prime Minister the benefit of my information. And I would like to quote from a document prepared by the St. Lucia Air and Seaports Authority entitled Civil Aviation Policy Framework with respect to the use of the airports. On the background, it states, and I quote, "In 1975, Mr. Charles Benton, an aerodrome specialist from the UK, was assigned to St. Lucia to set up the St. Lucia Control Zone. During that period, Mr. Benton reported on the operations at the then VG Airport, taking into consideration the physical characteristics of the aerodrome and the size of aircraft landing there. In his report, he recommended that only aircraft of a maximum takeoff weight of 50,000 pounds and under should allow to operate at VG Airport. The report further qualified this recommendation by stating high-performance aircraft, such as executive jets, should not be allowed to operate at VG," unquote. Madam Speaker, the recommendations of that report were implemented, but they quickly reversed that decision. And on Monday, November 30th, 1981, a McDonnell Douglas DC-6 aircraft, over 100,000 pounds, crashed in the area immediately north of VG Airport. The aircraft, which had developed a problem, was attempting to return to the airport after having been airborne for just 2 minutes. The three crew on board perished. Madam Speaker, at George F.L. Charles Airport, there is something recommended by ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, that when an aircraft takes off, it needs a clearway. After taking off, it needs an area free of obstacles so that it can make its climb and either turn left or right. At George Charles, they do not have that luxury. And immediately after takeoff, the aircraft must bank left to avoid terrain. And at low altitudes, if an aircraft stalls, it will crash. It will be fatal. So this is what the report was trying to address. Madam Speaker, I would like to quote from another document. And this is another document from the International Civil Aviation Organization. And it says on page 8, the only substantial possibility of the runway lengthening is to extend it westward and runway 08 into the Castries Harbor entrance waterway. A very limited and unsatisfactory option regarding increased air traffic interference with day-to-day harbor activities. The possibility of broadening the runway strip to meet ICAO standards is nil, except for the very small portion of land which must be leveled anyhow to become usable. There is no space enough to extend or relocate airport facilities and to locate necessary navigational aids, example, approach lighting systems. The airspace adjacent to the airport is afflicted with obstructions, creating serious hazard to aircraft operations. Moreover, most of them are to be regarded as of a permanent nature, unquote. So, Mr. Prime Minister, I would want you to be guided by such information. And finally, last report. A more recent one, Madam Speaker. It was done by Mr. Mikhail Vreninberg, the regional officer, aerodromes and ground aids from the International Civil Aviation Authority.
Just to inform you, Honourable Member, you have 10 more minutes within which to complete your presentation. Member for Castries East.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Good morning. Madam Speaker, I'd like to invoke Section 8210 of the signing orders and request an additional 30 minutes for the Honourable Member to continue his presentation.
Honourable Members, the question is that Standing Order 3210 be invoked to allow the Honourable Member for Labrie an additional 30 minutes. 13 minutes within which to complete his presentation. I now put the question, as many as are of opinion say aye, as many as are of a contrary opinion say no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it. You may proceed, Honourable Member.
Thank you very much, Madam Speaker, and my parliamentary colleagues for perceiving room for leniency to allow me the additional 30 minutes. As I indicated earlier, Madam Speaker, I'm quoting from a report by Mr. Mikhail Vreninberg, Regional Officer, Aerodromes and Ground Aids, from the International Civil Aviation Organization. It states on page 1, and I quote, the overall condition of facilities and services at George F. L. Charles were found to be generally poor with reference to ICAO aerodrome standards and recommended practices. The principal issue at George Charles is that the existing aerodrome physical configuration and facilities provided only satisfies ICAO Code 2 standards and recommended practices. Yet, current operations include Category 3, ATR 72, and Code 4 at the time a Amerijet was landing there, and four Code 4 aircraft. It is therefore recommended that operations at George Charles be limited to ICAO Code 1 and 2 aircraft types, and that operations by Code 3 and 4 aircraft types cease with immediate effect, unquote. So you see, Madam Speaker, in this country, we have been violating standards and recommended practices of the International Civil Aviation. Madam Speaker, let me change gears. And of course, all of those things, a lot of big dreams. Sir John had his dreams, and people around him, they embrace those dreams and want to come to this honorable house and put it in the pages of a document and say it's a budget. And that makes it a clean, clear one. Budget. Glossy things. Big dreams. But talking about dream, Madam Speaker, talking about dream. Just last night, I had a dream. I dreamt that I was in Cicero, Madam Speaker, in Cicero. And some kids were coming up the road and screaming. There was one commotion. And a little child told me, "Mr. Alva, you know what's going on there? Mr. Chu is wet. Mr. Chu, the Taiwanese ambassador. And his hands are dry. And he just gave our prime minister 29 cents. That's a strange dream. That he's wet. But his hands are dry. And he gave the prime minister 29 cents. But you see, when I took a look at the estimates again, I appreciated the dream, Madam Speaker. I saw for capital expenditure 29 million, only 29 million by Taiwan. It means that Taiwan hands dry. Only 29 million compared to 104 million from mainland China. And of course, I put it together. Mr. Chu Muye had a lot to do with him wet with the contaminated waters of undiplomatic behavior. And in the dream.
Members are free to criticize. But I think that there is a limit to which we will go, particularly when we're speaking about countries or representatives of countries who have a diplomatic relationship with the government of St. Lucia. I think it's fine to criticize, but I think that there is a limit, and we do not want to use this Honorable House and bring our proceedings into disrepute by speaking in a derogatory manner about representatives from other countries who have established formal diplomatic relations with St. Lucia. I am drawing that to your attention so that you choose your words very carefully. I think there is a limit to which we will go in this Honorable House.
Madam Speaker, thank you very much for the guidance. That's exactly what's important to me. You see, when foreign diplomats come to this country, they must respect the country. They must have respect for the people of St. Lucia. This is the point. Thanks very much, Madam Speaker. You assisted me in making that point so forcefully. And I shall move on. Madam Speaker, I remember during the time that the Labour government was in office, and of course, honorable members just came, criticizing the Labour government about debt. Debt, how they increase debt. Debt in this country. On page 9 of the budget, Madam Speaker, and I quote, "The national public debt increased by 8.4% to approximately 67.9% of GDP. As a ratio of GDP, total central government debt increased to 61.0% from 57.4% in 2006. Unquote. Madam Speaker, I hope that members opposite in government have learned a lesson. That when a government is managing the affairs of this country in a very competent way, and they do not understand why borrowings are necessary, they should not mislead the people of this country into believing that the government of the Labour Party at the time was actually burdening the people of this country with debt. Because we had to borrow, because during the glory days of the banana industry, we did not save to absorb those shocks. But members opposite made it look as if this was confined to the St. Lucian government. And I wish to quote from the Caribbean, from Vulnerability to Sustained Growth, on page 22. Since 1998, average ratios of public debt to GDP in the region grew rapidly, from 65% in 1997 to over 90% by 2004. It went further to state, reflecting the debt buildup, fiscal accounts worsened sharply during 1998 and 2004 in the Caribbean. The average overall fiscal balance declined in every country apart from the Bahamas, Guyana, and Haiti. During 1998-2004, compared with 1990-1997, as public debt grew, interest costs also rose. Hence, part of the explanation for the deterioration in the overall fiscal balance is the rise in interest-related expenditure. Unquote. Now we have a situation, Madam Speaker, where we are in difficult times. We are in a world that is not friendly to small, vulnerable economies like ours. This is a time you need serious and sober people to administer the limited resources of this country and to mobilize the people of this country to lead them effectively so that we can cushion the effects of those difficult times. This is a time where we should have a government that would cause the people of this country to organize themselves into that integrated whole. In that way, they shall create the conditions necessary for securing a more solid control of our collective destiny. They should be asking the people of this country to resist the gravity of the average and to declare independence from the will of the norm. But you cannot do that when you are victimizing members of the opposition or perceived members of the opposition. This is not a time for us to engage in any type of battle, unnecessary battle. And this is why I have always invited the government to a peaceful competition, not in unnecessary confrontation, but one in enriching the lives of our people. This is why I will invite the Minister for Communications and Works to come to my constituency and build my roads for me. I have been getting a lot of pressure about the Bunce Road. And every time I meet the minister, we have a discussion about our roads. But of course, Madam Speaker, consistent with my style, I do not demand things from government ministers. I cooperate fully with government ministers to ensure that I improve the lives of the people of my constituency. And I must say that I enjoy very cordial relations with all members on the opposite side. And I believe that's very, very, very important. I have invited the Minister for Social Transformation to my constituency so that we can set in motion our our playing field at Olibo. It's on a go slow. And you know why? I didn't blame the minister, although he was part of the arrangement. But that money that did not come from China affected his ability to deliver. And I told my people, it's not your fault. But this time around, there's no excuse. No. So, Madam Speaker, we want the Olibo playing field completed, the one at Laho, and I have already taken the Minister for Youth and Sports to Oje, where we were supposed to have built our playing field, because prior to the 2006 elections, the team of experts came down to Oje to look at the site for the proposed playing field and the site for the proposed multipurpose court, as well as a site for the multipurpose center. So I'm inviting the Honorable Minister for Youth and Sports and Social Transformation to come in my constituency and to address this situation as soon as practicable. Also, Madam Speaker, the Minister for Housing, I look at the Daily Z development at Lakwa. Proud had already come and put in all the necessary pegs to build the infrastructure. But of course, the December elections put a stop to the forward movement. And I'm hoping that as soon as you get out of your turbulence, Honorable Minister, through, Madam Speaker, that you pay attention to our pressing but legitimate needs in the People's Republic of Liberia. Madam Speaker, I believe that we are in very trying times, like I said a few moments ago. And the country calls for a situation that would establish order in her finances. St. Lucia is seeking extensive information. Men and women who are imbued with burning nationalism, men and women with the cerebral competence to deal with the situation. And I say so, not to take away anything from members opposite. I have indicated certain encumbrances that you all are role players, and the key players are doing whatever they want. The backseat drivers are in control. You can buy gas, you can chebe brakes. So this is an arrangement that will not take the country forward. But on this side of the house, we have a captain. He has been tried and tested. He navigated turbulent times. And he has men who are trained in navigation to ensure that we remain on course. A man who presided over a decade of revolutionary changes in this country. Kenyonomics. The country calls for another dose of Kenyonomics. And Madam Speaker, the Labour Party occupied this side of the house at a certain point in time. And look, we are here. The court of public opinion will decide in the fullness of time. In the fullness of time, Madam Speaker, whether or not on December 11, 2006, and I like the way the Honorable Member for Castle Central put it. He said, 12-1-1. I remember him on platform. And definitely, it was a surprise assault. But I believe that there is that collective wisdom among the people of this country. And when people go to the polls and they vote for government, we as an opposition must always accept the will of the people. Because at the Funky Rally in Beaufort last year, I called upon my fellow Liberites to accept the results of the elections. I didn't believe in any voodoo, anything like that. People went to the polls, and the majority voted for the United Workers' Party. And I told them to give the United Workers' Party an opportunity to govern. But I also said that the minority had their role to play in this country that would subject your policies, taxation, everything to systematic scrutiny. And I caution on one point, Madam Speaker, that when the former Prime Minister indicated that Tig Mom is on Tig Stilla and is going to engage in that pruning exercise to depoliticize the public service. Some will call it victimization. And I immediately call upon the then Prime Minister to secure peace in this land. Because if he victimizes the people of this country, if he victimizes the working class of this country, there'll be neither peace nor rest in this land, and the very foundations of this land shall be shaken. I thought people would have taken that as a very good comment, that you'd avoid confrontation with the social partners. Because we saw what happened with the banana farmers. The very foundations of this land were shaken. We saw what happened with the public servants and the teachers in 1995. But I'm telling you, I see that calm, despite all the turbulence with rising food prices, there is a calmness in this country. It means that the people of this country have started to acknowledge that they made a mistake on December 11, 2006. But I will allow the people on their own to respond to those circumstances. I will not tell the teachers or the civil servants or the farmers or other sectors what to do. But as an opposition, we will always articulate the issues affecting our people. And we await the moment for us to re-enter office and to take charge of the levers of power, unencumbered by backseat drivers, and deal with the pressing but legitimate problems of the people of this country. Principle we have in the Labour Party, talent we have in the Labour Party. All we need, fellow St. Lucians, is patience. Our time will come again. Our time will come again. And most people who do not understand how we went into a convention and voted with unanimous acclamation the leader of the opposition back to the leadership of the party. It's important we tell you that we appreciated the decade of revolutionary changes. And we are giving him another opportunity to take this party back to victory, back to government.
Do not forget, Honourable Member, that we are debating the appropriation bill.
Of course, it's appropriation bill because those hair needs to be inside of government to be able to repair the damage. That's why I'm speaking like that.
Well, you need to link your remarks to the proposals in the bill, general government policy, the financial and economic state of the country. That is what the appropriation bill is concerned with.
So I'm linking it to
you. You need to make the linkage.
That's the linkage I'm making, Madam Speaker, on page 50. When people, this administration, Madam Speaker, is committed to people-centered development. We see people as being key players in development and not merely spectators of the process. This is why I was saying about the key players and the role players. You see, that is the thing. That they are not key players in the government and they want to make the people of Central Lucia key players. That's what I'm talking about, the encumbrances, Madam Speaker. But like I said, our time will come again. Peace and love. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker.